From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, we talk to high school students going to the March for Our Lives in Washington.
I know that my parents weren't sitting in class bored, wondering if a shooter is going to come in.
One of our commentators says a Republican-sponsored plan to require work before receiving Medicaid should not surprise anyone.
Generally speaking, the Republican view is that if you're able to work and you're on a taxpayer-funded program like Medicaid is, you should be working.
Some startup tech companies are skipping Silicon Valley and choosing the Midwest.
Well, the biggest advantage is probably the most obvious one, which is cost.
A Penn State public relations advisor has some advice for Michigan State.
People don't want to hear, as I say, from institutions. They want to hear from people. They want to hear caring people that genuinely have, you know, a heartfelt interest in solving the problem.
We have an artisan of Michigan for you, and we say goodbye to a friend. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Tomorrow, people in cities around the country and around the state will be holding events to protest school shootings, such as the one in Parkland, Florida, where 17 students and teachers were killed. March for Our Lives gatherings will be held in Detroit, Lansing, Flint, Ann Arbor, Royal Oak, and other Michigan cities. One group of high school students is taking their activism to Washington, D.C. Berkeley High School students have been raising money to rent buses to take them to the March for Our Lives event in Washington. Joining us are two of those students, Chloe Halperin and Katie Wahlberg, who is the main organizer. Katie, why did you want to do this?
I think it's really important to get involved, and I really wanted to give other students the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. and essentially march for our lives. This is a big issue. Guns in schools is a really political big issue, and I think that by doing this trip, people are able to become more politically active, and, you know, hopefully we can lobby for a safer community.
Chloe, why was this important to you?
Really, everything Katie said, and it also seemed like a really great opportunity for to show not only our community, but our congressmen and women that we have opinions on these issues, and we're not blindly following what certain people think. Like, we have our own opinions, and we'll speak out. We're not too young to do something about it.
Well, I want to ask you about that a little further, but first, how many students are planning to go to this Washington, D.C. March for Our Lives from Berkeley?
So we have around 100 students and 10 parents.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
What's the message you want to deliver to Washington? What specifically do you want those members of Congress to know?
I think that we just want them to listen and want them to really understand that certain gun policies as of now are not effective, and that, you know, we are scared of something happening. And what we really want them to see is that we are the future and that we have the possibility to create change in our community.
Yeah, and I'd like to add that it really is a distraction from learning. I think I speak for a lot of students across the country when I say, this is a new issue. I know that my parents weren't sitting in class bored wondering if a shooter is going to come in. It's something that, especially in the past few months, it's something I think about, like, every day. When I'm in class, I'm like, okay, where are the exits? Where are the windows? And it's a distraction. We shouldn't have to be thinking about that.
You mentioned that. I know some of the schools across the state have had lockdowns for what turned out to be, well, basically an abundance of caution. I understand your school, Berkeley, had a lockdown recently. What were you two thinking when that happened?
I was really scared, to be honest. I think I was kind of hesitant. I really didn't think anything would happen, but there's always that threat, and there's always the possibility that, yeah, maybe it could happen to us. And having that lockdown just days after the Parkland shooting was really, really scary.
Yeah, and it was especially scary at first because there's kind of a lack of communication in the beginning, and so we didn't know what was going on. I think that communication aspect is really important because, again, with the same idea of us having a voice, like, we want to be in on every step of whatever process is going on, if that makes sense.
And as I understand it, the event that caused the lockdown was basically a bullet was found in one of the rooms, the gym or school room, where was
it? Yeah, the auditorium.
Mm-hmm. There have been a number of school shootings over the past couple of decades. What do you think it's been about the Parkland shooting that has led to students like you two taking action?
Well, one thing that's just so inspiring about it is the fact that, and so different from these past ones, is that it's students themselves they're standing up. You know, they're not waiting around. We've spoken up, but we've kind of been waiting around for this issue to be fixed, and clearly it hasn't. And I think seeing these kids who are 16, 17, 18, our age, you know, speaking in front of, like, I was just looking at the Time magazine, and some of the students from Parkland were on it, and it's really inspiring, and I think that it makes a lot of students want to be a part of that bigger movement.
Those kids are also getting a lot of criticism from people who are pro-gun and some pretty nasty things said about them. Are you too prepared to defend yourself in light of that kind of a backlash?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern in Washington, and I think there will be a lot of people that do not share similar opinions and share similar ideas to us, but I think that in holding firm in our beliefs and really showing that we care, this is purposeful, we're not doing this just to protest, we're not doing this just for publicity, we are really just trying to get our voices heard. And while there may be some backlash, while there may be some people against us, I think that there are also a lot of people with us.
Katie Wohlberg and Chloe Halperin are among a group of Berkeley High School students going to Washington, D.C. for the March for Our Lives event tomorrow, which is calling for ending school shootings. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, we travel the state every once in a while to talk to artisans. And this time, we're in Flint. C.H. Schultz & Sons has been repairing upholstery in cars nearly as long as cars have been around. Back in 1917, more than 100 years ago, Clyde H. Schultz was working at Buick and in the garage behind his house. A family business was born. Deborah Schultz-Pulaski is the third generation, and all that car history is inspiration for her.
You know, I've done this a really long time, so it's like you see some of the most fabulous cars that are original. The GTO was gorgeous inside, the last one was. And you just pull things from everything that you've seen and put it all together, and you just throw ideas at people, and they end up making the decision of what they want. But they come from all over. It's not difficult. That's the best part.
In recent years, there's been an explosion in car shows on TV that showcase some wild interiors.
All right, let's do this.
Tuesday on an all-new Counting Cars, the count scores a quick flip.
Yeah! You have the right to have a pimped-out car, and if you cannot afford one, West Coast will provide it for you. Now that's justice. Let's go.
So I was wondering if all those shows were causing her to get more business.
I don't think it's had any impact at all. But people now think that they can drop off a car and have a restoration done in 2 weeks, which is not how that works at all. It's usually at least a month to do a complete restoration.
It happens in a half hour on the show.
Oh, I know. That's unreal.
So you've got a range of vehicles from a new F-150 to what is that? A
38. Chevrolet.
I was talking about the Camaro here.
Oh, what? That's a 69.
69?
Uh-huh.
About the best year they made it,
uh-huh.
Isn't it?
That's correct.
And these others, is it like that all the time, that you've got this stretch between early makes to current models?
Oh, yes. We have people that just stop to visit to see what we have in the shop. We have our own car show every day.
I bet you do.
We do. We do.
I was just looking at Hudson and a Packard. The Packard looks like it probably did when it came off the showroom floor, or close, and the Hudson does not at all.
The Hudson came in, and he knew exactly what he wanted. In fact, I have never even met the man. He shipped the car to us and said, I want red with silver cords. So that's what we did. The Packard came, and we could not duplicate the material, so the owner actually got the material that they wanted, and we just did the labor on the whole thing. But that is original, exactly original.
Which do you prefer?
Probably custom. I love custom. There's no thought when you do original. You just duplicate what's there. We don't exactly duplicate. We try to make everything better than what it was ever produced. So when we reproduce it, everything is done correctly, so it lasts a long time that way.
When it gets busy at C.H. Schultz & Sons, Deborah spends more of her time just running the business, getting jobs in and getting jobs out of the shop. But that's not her favorite part.
I do like my hands-on. I really do. I thoroughly enjoy sewing. I don't install anymore because my hands don't have the strength, but I do enjoy sewing.
What about it?
What do I enjoy about it? The creative part of it, making sure it all fits together right. And I'm not as good as everyone here, but, you know, I'm good enough that most people don't know the difference.
Now, before I give you the impression they only redo upholstery for cars and trucks, Deborah starts talking about the other jobs she does.
Right now, we have a boat here. We have dental that we're picking up tonight, a dental office. These beds here are from blood donors. They're blood donor beds. We do ATVs. We do, actually, across the board, we do everything except for household furniture. That's the only thing we don't do. But motorcycle seats, Jeep tops, all sorts of Jeep things, just everything except for furniture.
Like I mentioned, this business has been replacing car upholstery for more than a century. But Deborah says there's never a dull moment.
The most entertaining part is you never do the same thing every day, ever. Even if it's the same seat cover you might be putting on, there's always something different on the other side. So it's never boring.
That's Deborah Schultz-Pulaski of C.H. Schultz & Sons, Incorporated in Flint. She's our latest Artisan of Michigan. Coming up, why some tech companies are choosing to skip Silicon Valley and stay in the Midwest.
People can make their money go much further, either by hiring employees or by renting the kind of space and software that they would need to get their company off the ground. That's an enormous advantage.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Let's talk with our regular Friday political commentators. Joining me now are Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. So some Republican legislators, led by Senator Mike Shirkey, want to require able-bodied Medicaid recipients to either be working, getting job training, or going to school in order to keep those Medicaid benefits. Shirkey is backed by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Chamber CEO Rich Studley had this to say about Medicaid in Michigan.
The program that was implemented is out of control. It is over-enrolled. It is underfunded. It does not contain many of the common sense reforms to encourage and support individuals as they work.
Vicki, what do you think of making able-bodied people work to be eligible for Medicaid?
I'm all for able-bodied people to work. That's why we have created Michigan Works and other works programs. However, this now ties access to health care, which should be unrelated to the workforce jobs programs, now ties it to access to health care. And that's problematic for a lot of reasons. Most importantly, 46% of all babies born in Michigan are Medicaid babies. So this bill disproportionately affects women and children. And in my own personal experience with a daughter who has been battling cancer, it makes it very difficult for those cancer patients to continue coverage for their treatment and really puts their lives at risk. It's a very dangerous proposal for the state of Michigan, and it's costly. We haven't even talked about the potential cost of implementing the program, making sure that we have the staff to keep the program in place, and even the Senate Fiscal Agency has taken a stand that it's going to cost between $20 and $30 million just to get this up and running, not to mention the cost of continuing to monitor it.
Ken, Senator Shirky says 300,000 of the 680,000 people on Medicaid could be working. What's your take on his proposal?
Well, Republicans have wanted to do this for some time, ever since the early days of Medicaid. It's part of the reason they generally prefer a Medicaid block grant from the federal government without a lot of strings attached. So this isn't a new idea, but the federal government basically sent the signal a couple of months ago that they're going to approve these requirements. They're going to approve states that seek federal approval for these work requirements or Medicaid recipients. Now, it's important to point out that in any of these states that are pursuing this, including Michigan, they would have exemptions. You know, they would exempt disabled people from working, parents of young children, pregnant women, the elderly, and there might be other exemptions from this work requirement. But generally speaking, the Republican view is that if you're able to work and you're on a taxpayer-funded program like Medicaid is, you should be working. As I pointed out, there will be various exemptions for people who aren't able to work for various reasons, but this is more about philosophy than it is about money.
Ken, you mentioned exemption for parents with young kids. I had not seen that, and I was thinking about, what about single parents with kids? They can't afford daycare with a minimum wage job. Vicki, Ken, either one of you, weigh in on that.
Well, not only can't they afford daycare, but we also have a transportation problem in most of the large cities in the state of Michigan where we don't have a robust public transportation system. So it's not just the work requirement, it's the daycare requirement and getting to and from a place of employment. And with minimum wage jobs, they're generally not offered for 30 hours a week or 29 hours as the new bill is trying to amend it. They're generally 20 hours or less per week. So it's a very difficult hurdle to get past. And in addition, I don't really care about a Democratic philosophy or a Republican philosophy, but any bill that is going to impact nearly two-thirds of the beneficiaries of Medicaid, which are women, is really a disgusting bill. So I think that this bill is aimed in the wrong direction, and philosophically taking people who need health care off of their health care is just something that we should not do in a civil society.
Ken, in your research, where did you see that exemption for parents with small kids?
Well, Kentucky recently received federal permission to do this, and I think the Michigan program, as I understand it, would basically be modeled after Kentucky, that any parent of a child below the age of six would be exempt from this work requirement. If it isn't in the current draft of the bill, I think it should be, because that makes sense to me.
But the current bill has a 90-day limit, so any parent who takes care of a child that's 90 days old or less is exempt from the work requirement. It was then proposed to go up to 180 days. I think they're now slowing down the bill to see if they can get it up to the 6 years, but that was not in the original bill.
Let's change topics here. On the face of it, I think most people would say gerrymandering distorts a representative democracy. However, Republicans are campaigning hard against a proposal expected to be on the ballot this fall that proposes an independent commission draw district boundaries rather than the politicians in charge. Vicki, the Michigan Republican Party says common sense and experience demonstrate that forming a nonpartisan commission is a pipe dream sold to voters looking to rig the redistricting process. Your thoughts?
Well, nobody seemed to have told that to former State Representative John Walsh, who now works for Governor Snyder, when he proposed Bill 5908 in 2010 that would require redistricting done by an independent commission, and points to the Legislative Services Bureau to take over those duties. That bill is well-crafted, and it could have been approved any time. that the Republicans really wanted to move forward on making sure that redistricting was fair in the state of Michigan.
Ken, the Voters Not Politicians group backing the Independent Commission to Eliminate Gerrymandering says the establishment elite comprised of strategists, politicians, and lobbyists are already out in force. And it goes on to say they're afraid of losing power, influence, and money when we end gerrymandering. What do you think of this back and forth between the Republicans and this group?
Anytime you are in a political year, which this is, and this is going to be a ballot proposal, people in Michigan are going to be subject to a lot of rhetoric. I think back to your original point about why is the Republican Party so upset about this, it stands to reason. They're a political organization. If this is adopted, they stand to lose whatever impact they have on redistricting, either the process or the outcome, even if it's a marginal impact, because my view it is somewhat marginal, but they'll lose it, and they'll lose it permanently because it's a constitutional amendment. So I think it stands to reason why they would be upset. Now, some of their arguments, I think, are a little over the top, and they probably don't serve their interests that well, in my opinion.
Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator, and Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you. It's good to be back, too.
Thanks, Lester.
Some startup tech companies are skipping the cutthroat atmosphere of Silicon Valley and instead opting for the Midwest. Here to tell us a little more about that is Matthew Scher. He wrote an article for California Sunday Magazine about that trend. How did you become aware of this trend of Midwestern tech companies?
It's something I'd been watching for a little while, and specifically watching what Steve Case had been doing with companies outside of Silicon Valley. Now, Steve Case started AOL way back in the day, and more recently, after he left AOL in the early 2000s, has been investing heavily in companies outside of Silicon Valley and New York. And he had embarked on this tour, a bus tour, called Rise of the Rest, where he'd visited cities from all over the country and held pitch competitions for companies in each of those cities. Detroit was included. And I've been tracking that for a while, and it just seemed like he'd really started to gain traction, especially in the last few months.
Yeah, you reported that Steve Case noted 80% of the venture capital investments go to the East and West Coast, leaving little to the rest. How successful was that tour? What did they manage to do?
Well, they had a big challenge ahead of them, right? I mean, those numbers that you cite, those are big numbers, right? I mean, a company can start anywhere in the country, right? We could start no matter where you are. Most people will be able to scrounge together enough to have a desk or go to a local incubator and be able to kind of get their company into the first phase. But in order to successfully really grow a company, you need venture capital cash in order to hire other employees and software developers and so on. So people in the Midwest especially were facing a major challenge. And Case, to his credit, didn't think of himself as sort of a messiah, that he was going to change everything instantly. What he did think he was going to do was draw attention to these communities around the country to kind of showcase and tell their stories, as he puts it, and to attract other kinds of investment. He's a big figure in the tech world. Press follows him wherever he goes. And in that sense, it was successful. You know, you had each of these tour stops, there were a lot of reporters there, and it did get written up. And as a result, people did start to take these tech scenes a little bit more seriously, and the money has started to flow in since he started doing it.
Yeah, you noted that they used to go looking for investors. Now they're being asked, hey, can I invest in this as well? You mentioned there are some sort of organic benefits of a handful of tech companies establishing in a Midwestern city versus Silicon Valley. What kind of advantages?
Well, the biggest advantage is probably the most obvious one, which is cost. Silicon Valley is notoriously expensive. Manhattan, which constitutes the other major hub, is notoriously expensive. And then Cambridge in Massachusetts near MIT is sort of the third one that people tend to mention, also really expensive. In cities like Indianapolis, which I visited, or cities like Detroit, real estate is cheaper. People can make their money go much further, either by hiring employees or by renting the kind of space and software that they would need to get their company off the ground. That's an enormous advantage. Now, the other advantage is that people in these parts of the country traditionally have had to move to Silicon Valley or New York to try to get their companies off the ground, or if they wanted a big lucrative software job. There's a big benefit in allowing people to stay because there's a happiness quotient, right? I mean, people generally speaking would prefer often to stay where they're from, where their family is from, if they can find the opportunity there. And allowing people to do that is a not insubstantial thing, right? I mean, it makes for happier employees. It makes for a more cohesive scene, in a sense. And that was certainly the case in Indianapolis, the city that I spent most of my time. You know, a lot of people were from all over Indiana. Some had come from Illinois. Some had come from Michigan. And they were, you know, they were happy to not have to empty out their bank accounts to go to Silicon Valley. They were happy to be where their friends were and where they felt supported.
You also mentioned that it's kind of cutthroat in Silicon Valley, and these companies in the Midwestern cities seem to collaborate a bit more, maybe a lot more, than they would in Silicon Valley. What advantages does that offer?
Yeah, I mean, look, Silicon Valley has been so flooded with hungry entrepreneurs, and there is a lot of venture capital out there, obviously, but the venture capital goes to the people who are hustling 24 hours a day and are really putting themselves out there emotionally. You know, Silicon Valley culture is such a thing that HBO can make a show called Silicon Valley that essentially parodies what that cutthroat environment is like. Now, in places like Indianapolis, it is friendlier. Now, I don't, you know, people talk about Midwest nice, maybe in a pejorative sense. I think that there is a sense that people are friendlier, that they're more supportive, that the scene is a little bit, it's not as far along as it is in Silicon Valley, so everyone's sort of mutually encouraging, and that's a good thing. I mean, I think that the people, if you ask the people that I spoke to and interacted with if they were happy and felt supported, 99% of them would say yes. And again, that goes to a more productive company, a more productive workforce, if they're happy.
You know, we Midwesterners are a happy lot because generally we just don't know any better. One of the entrepreneurs you featured in your article basically came up with an idea over having coffee with a friend, talking about Flint's water crisis. This character kind of ran through the length of the article. What happened there?
So the woman's name is Megan Glover, and she grew up in Indiana, not in Indianapolis, but in Indiana, and moved to Indianapolis to be a part of the tech scene about 10 years ago. She's in her mid-30s now. And she had seen all this coverage from Flint in Indianapolis. Apparently, it was pretty nonstop reports on the Flint water crisis. And what her innovation was she thought, okay, no one is allowing people to go out and test their own water in an easy way. There were home water testing kits, but they were difficult to use or they were expensive. So Glover's idea was, we're going to allow people to buy our product. People will sign on to her website. It's called 120 Water Audit. They'll order the product. A box will come to their house. Inside the box is a beaker. The consumer fills up the beaker with water, puts it back in the box. It's already self-addressed, leaves it out for the UPS man or the mailman, and the mailman takes it to be tested. And a few days later, the results are available on a website. It was something that had not been done with water in this way, and it proved to be, she has an interesting story because she wanted initially to try to target private consumers, individual consumers, but what she found was that the people who really wanted this were school districts, were governments, like the city of Pittsburgh bought her product, and so they will buy large quantities of it and distribute it to their schools or municipal buildings, and it's been a success. It's one of the success stories that is most striking because it is a story that has local roots, right? And this is something that you find with a lot of the companies, a lot of the startups outside of Silicon Valley, that people are looking at local problems that they're hearing about and are trying to engineer solutions. Whereas if you went to Silicon Valley, you know, it's about apps, right? It's about making money from those apps. And I think there is something, it's not always the case. Of course, there are people in Indianapolis and Detroit who want to make money, and as does Megan Glover. But there is a sense in which, okay, we're going to serve this community that we came from in some way. We're going to give back and be successful at doing it.
So bottom line it for us, how significant is tech becoming for Midwest cities, for their economies?
Well, it's huge. You know, I think that it is, it's hard to break the statistics down exactly because you get into kind of a mire of what you what you're defining as a tech job. But in cities like Indianapolis, you are seeing the business landscape be absolutely transformed by tech and by software. In Indianapolis, the biggest tower in the city is now owned by Salesforce, which is a San Francisco company which acquired a local Indianapolis company for over $2 billion. And you are seeing just an incredible amount of money flow through that city. You see a similar thing in Columbus, and Ohio is another big success. Pittsburgh is another big success. And Detroit is as well. It's a little, it's not quite as far along because it hasn't had the big, when local companies get acquired for millions or billions of dollars, it creates this groundswell where the people who get bought out typically reinvest inside that, those communities. And that hasn't happened yet in Detroit, but I think that the hope is that it will soon. And this is not an insignificant thing. It's something that really does have the opportunity to change how these cities operate.
The article's title is Does Tech Need Silicon Valley? Startup founders throughout the Midwest are doing something new, staying. You can find it online at californiasunday.com. The author is Matthew Scher. Thanks for telling us about the article.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Still to come, a Penn State public relations advisor has some advice for Michigan State.
People don't want to hear, as I say, from institutions. They want to hear from people. They want to hear caring people that genuinely have, you know, a heartfelt interest in solving the problem.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. This week, an article in The Atlantic blasted Michigan State University for its handling of nearly every aspect of the Larry Nassar scandal. He's the former MSU physician who sexually abused girls and young women despite complaints dating back to 1997. The article focused on how MSU is, quote, botching its reputation rehab, end quote. One of the experts interviewed for the article is Jeff Hunt. He's a partner and co-founder of Pulse Point Group and the author of the book Brand Under Fire, a new playbook for crisis management in the age of digital. He joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
You are quoted as saying Michigan State has a much bigger problem than Penn State after the sexual abuse scandal there involving child molestation of boys attending a football camp. Why do you feel MSU has a bigger problem?
I think it's a bigger problem on two levels. First, the sheer number of victims that were abused and the time period over which they were abused makes it a very complex situation relative to Penn State. Secondly, their very, very delayed, slow response to the situation. I mean, if you compare the two, I mentioned this in the Atlantic article, that you know, by the time Sandusky went to trial, Penn State was well into making retributions to the victims and also demonstrating its willingness to do things to ensure this never happens again and to help others. And, you know, in the case of Michigan State, I think they're really late to the game. I would say that the new appointment of the former governor, they seem to be taking some actions now that are in the right direction, but it's just really late in my view.
We should mention you were a public relations advisor to Penn State University during the Jerry Sandusky scandal. What lessons should Michigan State have learned from Penn State?
You know, first and foremost, with Penn State, they were not concerned with liability first. They were concerned with making sure that they addressed the victims. And I wouldn't say they just, you know, willingly opened up their wallet, but it was very clear from the outset that that wasn't going to be a barrier, meaning that they were going to take care of those victims, and they encouraged the victims to come forward so that they could reach a settlement agreement with them individually. And so I think that's a, you know, a smart approach. You know the expression penny wise and pound foolish, but in these situations, people are watching your every move to see, you know, are you really genuinely regretful for what happened? And a lot of times what they look for is how you treat the victims.
So let's step back a couple of steps. What do institutions and corporations not understand about crisis management in this digital age?
Well, first off, they don't understand that digital and social media really emerged as a result of fundamental mistrust of institutions. we've always known that peer-to-peer communications has always been favored. And so these social technologies have really scaled intimacy and allowed conversations to happen between peers. And the other thing is that these channels don't like institutional voices. So, in my view, there's five things that you really have to take to heart. Number one, authenticity. People don't want to hear, as I say, from institutions. They want to hear from people. They want to hear caring people that genuinely have, a heartfelt interest in solving the problem. Second is transparency. You have to assume that everything is discoverable. A vacuum gets created when a crisis like this occurs, and it either gets filled by us, meaning Michigan State, or it gets filled by others. And, over the length of time that it took them to respond to this, clearly it was being filled by many others, and their narrative, was way, way late to the game. And that, sort of leads me to the third, which is speed. You really have to move quickly because we're not operating in a 24-hour news cycle anymore. We're operating in a nanosecond news cycle. And so, again, they were really late. And then agility. So you heard others say in the Atlantic article that they appear to be tone deaf. If you're releasing comments or you're taking actions and it's not having the intended effect, you need to be able to kind of restate those or redo them, or rethink them. So the ability to be agile. And then, lastly, the ability to be creative. When I say creative, I don't mean, paint fancy pictures. I mean the ability to be really creative in helping people understand how you're responding to the crisis.
In your book, Brand Under Fire, you outline those, what you call six stages of crisis. But the urge is to put out a defensive press release, minimizing the issue, and then bunker down.
That's right.
Why? That's our impulse. So why doesn't that work?
I think, in a lot of cases, you have, the overwhelming inertia is legal and the fear of liability. And it's a big boulder to move. But I think smart organizations, smart institutions, are really starting to recognize that, again, in this day of digital and social media, the court of public opinion weighs really heavily also in on the legal case. So particularly when you're dealing with class action suits, you'll see that how quickly an institution moved to address the situation is often a big factor. I always tell people that in a situation like this, there are four things that you are going to have to get to in order to bring closure. First off, number one, people want to know what happened. And I still don't think that there's a great accounting of exactly what happened with Mr. Nassar and his victims and how, as it relates to Michigan State, as it relates to the Olympics. So that's the first thing. I mean, people will give you the benefit of the doubt in the early going that perhaps you couldn't put it all together. But at some point, they expect a full accounting. Number two, they expect to be able to understand what you did in the moment. And they're going to judge you on what you did in the moment, good, bad, or indifferent. And number three, they want to know what you're going to be doing to mitigate it and make sure it never happens again. What steps are you taking? And then number four, they want to know what you're doing to make the world a better place. So the reason we have tamper-proof packaging is because of Tylenol. The reason that we have double-hull tankers is because of the Exxon Valdez. So if you look at Penn State, for example, they took a big chunk of that money, like $15 million, and they invested it in putting in institutes to really educate on this whole subject of child molestation. So they did something right. They learn from their mistake, and that's what people expect you to do in these situations. And I think Michigan State is, a long ways from that.
You talked a lot about information vacuum. You mentioned it earlier. I've seen as a reporter, and I'm sure you've seen in your career, the attempt to fill that vacuum with public relations, I'll call it spin, that simply tries to persuade the public to just see it our way. Typically, how successful is that approach?
I don't think it's successful. I mean, I think what you can do is you can, in the early hours, you can begin to fill it with process. And what I mean by that is that while I may not know exactly what happened, I can tell you what I'm going to do to find out what happened. And so the more information you can provide early on, again, to demonstrate that you're going to be transparent and authentic, the better. Again, speed is a critical factor. So I don't think you can just fill it with a bunch of spin. I think that's, again, that's yesterday. That's the old playbook. The new playbook is be authentic, be transparent, be genuine in letting people understand what you're trying to do to solve the crisis. And most importantly, be conscious, be caring, be respectful of the victim. And that's what most people believe has been missing in this Michigan State case, that they have not put the proper amount of attention on the victims. And that was certainly not the case with Penn State.
I liked the argument you made about transparency, saying it's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of when and how to disclose information. Let me ask you to bottom line this for us. What kinds of things should the Michigan State University Board of Trustees and the interim president be doing right now?
First off, get a full accounting, very publicly known, of what happened. you know, with as much detail as they possibly can provide. And then secondly, I think they should move very quickly to address the victims, you know, one at a time, or, you know, however they decide that they're going to bring that forward. But they need to really show that they genuinely want to take care of these victims. I think they need to look culturally at what were the things that allowed this to happen in the first place. You know, when you get to these situations, you look at, like, for example, what's going on at Uber or Facebook. When you start to see these things happening or occurring often, generally there's a cultural issue that's at the core. Until you fix the cultural issue, meaning, are we an organization that is committed to being transparent? Are we an organization that's committed to being authentic? If you don't have that figured out, then, you know, you're just basically waiting for the next crisis to occur. So those are some of the media things I would do. Obviously, they've got a lot of key constituents. You know, you've heard the students are very, very upset, so they've got to regain trust and confidence with the students and demonstrate to the students and the faculty that they are deeply committed. They've got to give them, you know, as weird as this may sound, they've got to give them something to be proud of. And, you know, in the Penn State case, while it was a fairly divided constituent group in terms of who favored what the interim president did, in that case Rodney Erickson, and those that didn't, at the end of the day, I think if a Penn Stater looks back, they can say, we handled it in a respectful way. We're proud of our institution. We're proud of the way that we dealt with it. We're not proud of what happened, for sure. And we're not proud that we had a system that would let it happen. But we got the wake-up call, and we did the right things.
That is Jeff Hunt. He's crisis management expert and author of the book Brand Under Fire, a new playbook for crisis management in the age of digital. He also was a public relations advisor to Penn State University during the Jerry Sandusky scandal. Thanks for taking some time to talk to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We at Michigan Radio lost one of our colleagues recently. Mark Brush died of brain cancer at age 49. Mark started at Michigan Radio in 1998 and most recently was the director of digital media. He's survived by a large, loving family, including his wife, Andrea, his children, Elias, and Cecilia. The Environment Report's Rebecca Williams and I worked with Mark from his earliest days at Michigan Radio. We recently sat down to share memories of Mark and what he did to make Michigan Radio stronger for you. What do you think some of the significant mile markers were for him in his career?
I think one of the things that he was really proud of was the work that he did investigating the status of Enbridge's Line 5.
That's the first thing that came to my mind. I don't think another reporter did more or deeper work than Mark did on Enbridge Line 5.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, that he always ran towards the hard stories. He had a science background, he had a political science background, and he'd tell me, okay, I'm going to do this story on mercury pollution. It would be something really complex. And then he would later, we'd commiserate about how hard it was. And he'd say, why did I choose this story? But he always went toward those stories that were really complex. And he brought clarity. And he told you as a listener, here's why you should care about this. Here's why this matters to you.
You know, I don't think the listeners understand just how many of these really big stories, these nationally award-winning stories that Mark was involved in. I'm thinking of the series and documentary that we called Coal, Dirty Past, Hazy Future, you know, that won an Edward R. Murrow and some other national awards. And one of the things he insisted on was making sure that we go to West Virginia and talk to coal miners and make sure that we had their perspective. And he kept bringing in things. I think, wow, this is going to be a lot more work. And you were in charge of that project. But Mark kept pushing us on some of these angles that really took it a lot farther than we otherwise would have gone, I think.
Well, and he's always reminding us to find the personal stories, right?
You know, and he brought that, well, for instance, he went after polluting factory farms. And this is stuff that hardly got any coverage otherwise in the media, but he went after it and went after it hard. And yet he's not one of those really aggressive people. He's one of the nicest guys you ever meet, but he knows how to get to that story and get people to talk because that's Mark. I mean, people love him first sight. I don't think the guy had an enemy on the earth. It really is interesting that he could be such a really driven reporter and always so nice about it. What do you think was the most important thing he did for you as a journalist?
I think just always feeling like, he edited a lot of my stories, and I always felt like he was a tough editor. You know, I would get a script done and I'd come to him at 4 p.m. for an edit, and I need to turn it around that same day. And he'd say like, okay, sorry, Rebecca, but I'm going to have you restructure this whole thing. And it would be better. It would always be better. And I knew that I could take some risks and I could push myself. And he would tell me if I went too far. He would tell me if I didn't go far enough. I just trusted him.
You took him on some trips you did too, like going to Isle Royale to do the wolf and moose story. Mm-hmm. Why'd you choose Mark?
I knew it would be a great adventure, and I knew that he would help bring the most important stories out of that trip.
How did he do that?
Because he and I would sit with people, and we would ask them questions together, and he would ask the questions that I would miss. And he took video and photos on that trip too, and I just feel like, I mean, for example, we were on the ferry ride over. It's a couple-hour ferry ride over, and he said, we need to go interview the ferry captain. Because this is this remote wilderness island.
In the middle of Lake Superior.
It's the least visited national park, right? But I think now it's the most revisited national park. They're drawn to it.
Yeah, once you go, I mean, you want to go back.
Yeah, you've been there. It's amazing, right? But how do we capture the magic of that place? And Mark said, well, we should talk to the ferry captain. He goes here all the time and he brings people here, all for decades. So he would know. And he did. And he brought this one person's story out, and it was, he just had a way of finding out what was missing when you're telling a story.
Mark wasn't worried about shining, and yet he did. He became someone our editors trusted, someone our reporters trusted, and I've, as we've found since Mark died, some of these people who have been at the station for reasonably short time, a year or two, end up to the same degree that we do, just simply because they knew they could trust him and he would help them and he would guide them when they needed it. And that, I think that helps make Michigan Radio the strong journalistic operation it is. And the other thing he knew and we all embraced was, you're never good enough. You got to keep going. You got to learn more. You got to get better. And we never feel like we're good enough. We have to get better. And he was one of the leading proponents of that. He encouraged people, keep striving. This is good. Let's do better next time. In the last few years, last part of his career, Mark was the digital director. And I wonder, what do you think his hopes and dreams for Michigan Radio's future might have been? Or do you know?
Yeah, one of the things that he's been working on this past year is a digital plan for the future of the station. And because he's Mark, he didn't want to do some Microsoft Word document that nobody would look at again. He made a cartoon. And he did this graphic visualization of our future. And he wants a real digital team, a really strong digital team, because that's everything is multimedia now. So he imagines us going out into the community and having...
Now, when you say cartoon, you mean like a graphic novel or something?
Yeah, it's like a graphic novel.
Oh, I saw something out on the table, but I haven't looked at it yet. Oh, so that's Mark's plan for our future?
Yep.
I love that.
That's the last thing that he did.
That's so Mark.
he's irreplaceable. I've been thinking a lot about his legacy. And I think about how, when I think about the meaning of life, I think about the way Mark lived his life. And I think about how important it is to do meaningful work, but it's so much more important to take care of people around you. And he took care of everyone.
Hi, I'm Mark Brush with the Environment Report. I'm in the middle of Michigan's largest wind farm, and I'm standing right under a wind turbine. It was a few days before Christmas, and I was out at a strip mall. Workers had made a forest with trees that were quite tall.
So this really was an area where, you think about the industrial age and how factories located on rivers.
Help, help, help.
There you go. Diapers changed.
You're all done.
So what do you think about diapers, Andrea?
The water in the Straits of Mackinac is wild. I found that out when I went to meet a group of Enbridge contractors about a year and a half ago.
All right, and thanks very much for sharing your thoughts with me. I really appreciate it.
That's right, bees rule. At least that's what my second grader thinks after she studied them in school.
You wrote bees rule. Why do bees rule?
I think it's neat for how they... that they can make it into honey.
Okay, they've got doors and wind. How about the sound for that doll that can put a curse on people? So back to our question, what's the status of the old Enbridge oil pipeline under the Straits of Mackinac? As one expert told me, the jury is still out. She had blue hair and an interesting ringtone.
What's up, sucker?
Don't mind my phone. Yes. Tiny Tina.
They were all smiles and hugs and high fives. It's not your typical ending for a college-level English class. For Stateside, I'm Mark Rush.